There are a bunch of things we're going to do today. What happened here? So one of which is continuing the discussion on who annotates the data, and through that go into information extraction, which is the next topic. Before I go there, are there questions on what we have been discussing? Yes. No, I mean, I'm not completely sure I understand the question. So there are techniques for doing
keyword search on XML.
Yeah.
Random keyword search also, and they use XML.
Yeah, but I mean, that was, I mean, XML was designed to be able to support both IR and database style retrieval, right? So, so how does what fit in?
Should I consider it a better technique to retrieve data than if query, or because it gives
Well, it depends. The idea is, it's an interesting question. We will talk about this in a minute. I mean, I think a little later when we talk about there is a set of topics that I'll be discussing called bringing databases and IR together. And so the question is, when you have structure to the data, it makes sense to have structured querying such as XQuery or SQL. But on the other hand, if your users can only ask keyword queries, then you need to support those on structured data. So both are right in some sense. So if you have structured data, you should be able to support structured querying on it. Sorry, no, let me put it this way. If you have unstructured data, you should be able to extract the structure and support structured querying on it. And if you have structured data, you should still be able to support IR style querying on it. Okay, both are needed. Okay, for different motivations. In one case, because users are only asking keyword queries and you need to support them for the databases. In the other case, you know, if you have structured, the sort of queries that you can ask with structured querying are much more than the sort of queries you can ask with keyword queries. So it's not, it depends on where you situate yourself. If you think that all queries forever and ever would just be keyword queries, then why do you care about XQuery to begin with? Right? I mean, you can't, even if I have structured data, if all you are doing is keyword queries, I can't really help you too much. I mean, because you cannot ask questions such as, show me all the papers that were written by Rav. I mean, that cite Rav's papers that are not written by Rav. How do you ask that query? Okay. So, but on the other hand, if you are asking such questions, you know, queries, if you want to support them, then you need the structure. There's like a mishmash of topics in this whole part, and I assume that there would be questions like this, but I'm hoping that you'll bring them up, so we'll discuss. I don't think I know the answer exactly. There are motivations for solving any of these problems. Okay. And then under certain assumptions, these problems are not interesting. So if you think, for example, everybody is only going to ask keyword queries to Google, right, then you should not care about XQuery. You should not care about SQL. You should not care about the whole area of databases. Okay. Other questions? So, did people understand the question of how does semantic web standards RDF, RDFS connect to XML? Did we get, I mean, are there any questions on that? So I have 4 papers due tomorrow. I'm reading all of them at the same time, so I can imagine why I am jaded. So what's your excuse for being jaded today? It looks as if some people are missing. I know news has been really sad, but not quite sure. Even the people who are here seem to be shell-shocked. Maybe because of the news, but maybe also for some other reasons. The question of semantic web, are there any issues on RDFS, RDF, and XML? Yes? RDF is, as I said, it's just providing a syntactic standard for writing logical assertions. And they decided to use XML syntax. That's all.
You said that RDF is kind of a standard of XML.
RDF is a standard on top of XML. So RDF is also using XML syntax. So it's not I don't know that there is anything called a standard of XML. XML has its own standard. XML schema is the entire standard of XML. Okay. But then lots of other things use XML syntax for very different reasons. RDF is using it just to write down base facts in logical theories. But they use XML syntax for doing that. So the question is, RDF is a standard that you can use to write down any declarative knowledge that you have about the contents of a page. And the group of people who think this is the way you can bring structure to the web and support structured querying, the specific group of people who think this way are the semantic web community. Okay. Again, the big issue is everybody is interested in bringing structure to the web, in the sense, you know, if you don't do natural language processing, and if you already have, all you have is text and plus, you know, other media, you can only go so far with keyword-based queries, so far with bag of words analysis. Okay, so how do you take the next step? How do you to go to the next step, you need to have the structure of the page. You need to have facts rather than bag of words. Okay, and things that connect the facts. So that's one way of doing it is logical theories. That's what semantic web is pushing. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one issue, as I said, is you don't really, even people believing in semantic web don't actually believe that everybody is quickly going to change over to not writing, to writing pages only in logic, right? So the idea is web ultimately is going to still exist in human readable form. But it might have logical knowledge in the background. So this is like extra, it's annotation on top of what already you can read. Okay. So the hope is you read English, you understand. You read whatever natural language, you understand. The hope is that the machines which are processing these pages can at least get some of the same benefits that you can get by reading and understanding the entire content. Okay. And doing so without depending on full natural language understanding, if it is text, and then full computer vision, if it is images, and full audio perception, if it is music. Okay, all of which we can do because we have a reasonable ways of understanding that. So what can you do to get your machines to do that? And the idea would be that for just the text part, you would probably assume that you can write, semantic web would assume that you would write this RDF facts and the RDFS theories in the background. Okay. Now, in general, everybody ultimately wants to, as I said, go from text to structured data. Okay, so at least keep some of the, if you know some of the structure of the pages, you want to be able to keep it somewhere and use that to improve the retrieval. So the question is, much of this winds up being sort of adding on top of the text, annotating the text with extra information. If you're a semantic web guy, you annotate it with RDF statements. Okay, and RDF is schema state, background knowledge. The question, of course, in general is, who is going to do these annotations? You could do it, just the users might want to do it. Okay, and if they don't do it, then are there any large-scale ways of doing this? And I have no clear answers. All I can tell you is, what are the directions that people are considering where this kind of annotation will slowly happen? Okay, one, of course, is somehow interested in the way the pages are constructed, such that I mentioned this last time, such that you have extra annotations, you know, in RDFS or in RDF, for example. Okay. Now, in terms of RDFS itself, which is this schema, which is a background theory, there are people who are actually out there trying to develop the entire common sense knowledge of the world and write it down once. So what a four-year-old kid already knows, essentially. Okay, and write it down somewhere so that if you write it, let's say, in that one single RDFS fragment, which is actually impossible because RDFS doesn't have the expressiveness. But if I write it down once, presumably everybody can make pointers to it. Okay, there are, this is like a long-standing dream of some of the people. There is this whole company, what's his name? Does anybody remember Doug Leonard's company? I just forgot. This guy, Doug Leonard, has a company, remind me, I just blanked out right now, which has been trying to just develop this. And, you know, about 30 years back, they said, in 3 years, we'll have this ready. About 20 years back, they said, we'll have it ready in 3 years. And it's still been three, you know, it still is not ready, in essence. But large pieces of it are ready. Okay, one other interesting thing is, one of the interesting things is that if that background knowledge exists in some place, other people can make connections to it. They can make a pointer and use the same vocabulary to do their RDF annotation. Okay, yes? Psyche. Sorry. The name of this guy is Psyche, C-Y-C. Yeah.
No, sir, it just seems to me that from last lecture and this lecture, maybe it's just because of the similarity in the representation, but there seems to be a lot of connection between this kind of thing, the this RDFS approach and all that, and AI, where you're trying to give knowledge to your, say,
that's the point. So basically, the older theories of not all of these. The classical AI theories of inference essentially say, put this in a representation language and use the inference algorithms for that particular inference procedures for that language. And depending on the representation language, the inference procedures change. The one specific one that everybody knows is deterministic first order logic, for which there are inference procedures. There are also probabilistic logics for which there are inference procedures. Okay. What's funny actually is that semantic web is using deterministic first-order logic representation. Okay, and that's it made a specific commitment to that. Okay, so there are ways in which people are potentially trying to push semantic web forward. So some of the semantic web people are busy developing the standards and hoping that people will start using it any day now. And others are more interested in adaptation of the existing standards, and realizing that nobody is actually going to adopt them and write, you know, these annotations. So you somehow either do it yourself, you, the guy who wants semantic web to happen, does it themselves, or you sort of find indirect ways of providing annotation support. Okay, so there is this, which we talked last time, there is this whole area of collaborative tagging for which which is sort of a new growing thing, where basically people just put tags without, you know, all they're going to say is they'll just use keywords to describe the things that are out there. Okay, so if there are pictures, they can describe, they can add a tag to the picture saying, oh, this is a tiger. They don't have to write a full sentence. They can just say tiger. And then if there are enough people who are looking at the same corpus of images, these tags can help, for example, help you figure out what these pictures are without actually having to do image understanding and object recognition. But the same thing can also be done for text. Okay, you could say this page and then you tag it with some words. Okay, now one can say that those kinds of tags really can then be converted into some RDF format if you want, because that's extra knowledge about the page. And then somebody, you know, if you want to write a better query processor for these unstructured pages, we will then use these tags to improve performance. Okay, there are two ways, I mean, there are several things that are going on here. I'll talk a couple of things, I mean, a couple of slides on this. One, of course, is this folksonomies, where people just put any keyword that comes to their mind in describing pictures, in describing music, in describing YouTube videos, in describing pages, in describing stories, anything. Okay, and there are also things like ESP game, which are also trying to do this. Now, the real issue in collaborative tagging is somehow getting unsuspecting public to do it for you. The real issue here is interceding in the creation of each page and somehow make people, without realizing, put extra structure into their page. Here, you are making unsuspecting people do it. And the third approach is to heck with the people. You know, they are never going to listen to me anyway. I'll just read the page myself. When I say I the, you know, search engine, I the whatever, the machine which wants, the program which wants to, you know, have access to structure. So it has another aspect, another piece of this program which offline gets as much of the structure of the page as possible and then, you know, remembers it as annotation. So if you are a semantic web guy, all these annotations can potentially be represented as RDF statements. Once you got annotations, how do you represent it? You need some formal language for it. You know, you could use RDF, for example, for that. Okay? So that's how the tagging, the entire annotation is connected to semantic web ideas. But let's talk about these two, collaborative tagging first, and then we'll start talking about information extraction. There's not too much to say other than admit that these are ways of doing annotation of pages. Okay, I don't really know that we understand enough about how to make these things happen. So for example, in the case of folksonomies, it's completely bottom up. People are adding words, you know, tags for pieces of music or whatever. Okay, and the hope is that these, you know, you're just facilitating. You, the, you know, the program which has access to all the music, all these objects, and then you're also facilitating users to look at them and add tags. All you're going to do is keep track of these tags, okay? And then you would basically, the hope is that popular tags will start getting used more. Okay, now in the beginning there is no popular to begin with, but then as things reach a reasonable steady state, popular tags will get used more and more. And so instead of asking people to say that if you say a tiger, write tiger, don't write Bengal tiger, don't write, you know, something else, just write tiger. Rather than say that, you just allow people to write whatever it is they want, but you give them, you know, in some sense there's an indirect benefit structure which allows people to get benefit if they use, you know, more popular tags. Okay, so in the case of something like Flickr, if you use a very hard to, a very rare tag, then nobody is going to find it, essentially, because how do you make that tag be, people are going to search for pictures, let's say, using these tags, and you're interested in having your picture be seen. If you don't want your picture to be seen, don't even tag it. Why bother tagging? Okay? And if you want your picture only to be seen by one particular friend, just send them the URL. The only reason you are tagging your own pictures, for example, or any pictures that you want other people to see, is because you want people to see it by searching on these tags. So there is this indirect reward structure wherein if you use popular tags that people are likely to search anyway under, then you are better off. Okay, so there is obviously this tension between highly popular tags that you know people are going to search for but have nothing whatsoever to do with this page, versus highly specific tags which are very specific to this page but nobody is going to search in. So every individual user finds something in between and then gives that tag. And you're just letting it happen. All you're doing is just letting it happen. Okay. And so of course, you know, it's now like a big deal, everybody does it, but the time when I first started doing these things, I mean, there were like only a couple of companies which were doing Delicious and various others which were supporting this sort of collaborative tagging, folks anonymous. Now, there are some good things about folks anonymous, there are some bad things about them. The good things are nobody decides what the ontology is. You know, one can say actually these tags are the things under which the search is going to happen. So it's the ontology. It's basically the concepts under which various pictures are organized right now. Okay. So in a way, folksonomies, the word folksonomies is derived from the word taxonomies. Didn't exist more than 4 years back. But taxonomy is just a hierarchy of concepts. So this, so things, living things, non-living things. In the living things, creepy crawlies, cute things, and so on. Okay, so all you have is a bunch of concepts that are hierarchically organized. So that's a taxonomy. Okay, and another word for these taxonomies are ontologies. So because these are the base fact predicates, if you will. Okay, and this taxonomy is telling you subset relations. Okay, so for example, creepy crawlies are living things which are part of things. Okay, now folksonomies are essentially allowing users to define these pieces in an emergent fashion. Okay, it's good because nobody has to sit down and write the entire ontology. Okay, and then force people to use it. But the bad, of course, is there's really no control over these names. Okay, people can essentially tag anything with anything, first of all, that's clear. And secondly, people are likely to use new synonyms without realizing. The only hope is that just because if you are interested in tagging it, you probably are interested in getting customers to this, to look at this page. And so you are likely to give tags that are somehow connected to the page and somehow connected to the popular tags. But that's just a very weak beginning. Okay? So there's obviously there's a lack of precision. Nobody told, many a time, in fact, you can on YouTube, for example, you can give a tag, and if you don't know anything better, if you say Beatles, you might see a video which has nothing to do with Beatles the group. And after about 3 seconds, you realize it is some other band completely. But some guy basically thought that this is Beatles. Okay, that's it. And nobody is going to question. Hopefully, the tags that have been added to a page more often are likely to be higher importance descriptions of that page. And the ones that are rarely added are less important. But other than that, there are going to be part of them. Nobody is going to be challenged on this. Yes? Yeah, flat taxonomy by definition is also a taxonomy. So that's the other problem with folksonomies, because nobody actually ever says this is part of this, this is part of this. They just keep adding tags. So it's really flat taxonomy. Okay. So in fact, there is a hidden set-subset relation among them. But set-subset, one thing that I want you to remember is on the web, people just keep focusing too much, I believe, and this set subsetness, as if that's the only kind of background knowledge you have about concepts in the world. Okay, but that's just one piece. In general, obviously, meaning comes because of how concepts are related to other concepts. And if you are in logical theories, you talk about, you know, axioms that relate multiple predicates. Okay, it's a one very specific type of axiom is for all x, a of x implies b of x. That basically means everything which has the property a also has the property b. That's all. Okay, but there are many more logical, many more interesting connections between concepts than just that. But this is just, when you think of ontology, think of it as background knowledge. That actually will be very helpful because you do it a lot more than just is a hierarchy. Okay, but that's the beginning, yes.
So basically what you're saying is that the natural or the order of things is not a tree but a graph.
It will also be a graph, but it's more than that. I mean, not only just a graph, but it could actually be that A and B implies C, or A and B implies B, A and B implies C or D. Any logical sentence constrains the model, you know, if you think in terms of knowledge representation. So it's just these are a beginning, you know, is a hierarchy is a beginning, but it's not them, you know, you should not think of that as the only thing. Okay, but if you come from taxonomies, then foxonomies are flat taxonomies. Okay, and then you can compare them to handmade taxonomies, and they have the connection, obviously, is that there's very few guarantees you can make, but on the other hand, no single person needs to spend time making the taxonomy and forcing people to use it. You know, so there's a huge advantage there. Okay, so the question is, how can you use what is already happening to your advantage, to the advantage of the query, the searcher, so that it will do better search? Okay, clearly you can do some, you know, having the tags does improve retrieval. Okay, but then all these other issues of adversarial nature of the web and the fact that nobody is sure, I mean, you cannot guarantee that the tag actually describes what is in the page, etc. All of that's an issue. You can't help it. Okay, so and then there's also this whole it's all fat, you know, there is structure. People might wind up using multiple tags, all of which mean the same thing, or they have this set-subset relationship, and there is no nobody is constraining anybody from sticking to a particular set of terms other than just popularity. Okay, popularity of tags. So, in fact, I've heard this said that, you know, Wikipedia to encyclopedia is like folksonomies to handmade ontologies. Okay, and that's a very good analogy, I think. I mean, there's like a huge raging debate as to Wikipedia is reasonable, or you still need Encyclopedia Britannica, and you guys know some of the answers, but, you know, anybody can change Wikipedia entries. But hopefully they'll get changed back if there are enough people who are keeping their eyes. But this whole folksonomy is, as I said, part of this collaborative computation. So many, many people looking at the web, and they have enough intelligence, and if you can somehow find ways, mechanisms, design mechanisms wherein they're going to use their brain cycles to help you, it's useful. Okay. There are all these other statements, for example, what is it, Eric Raymond says that with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Okay, so if enough people are looking at something, right, then even if there's a deep bug in it, somebody will catch it. So it's like the advantage of having lots of people working for you. Okay, but unfortunately, it's not easy to get people to work for you. Okay, folksonomies are a reasonable beginning, but folksonomies don't happen everywhere. And it happens on YouTube, yeah, and it happens on, you know, but it doesn't even happen on images, for example. Google images or any search engine's images, there's nobody sitting there annotating them with words describing what is in the page. So a big issue, of course, is how do you happen more interesting forms of mass collaboration when folksonomies are just a poor beginning? It's not enough. Okay, so other steps are, for example, one of the problems with folksonomies are the quality of tags generated through folksonomies is notoriously hard to control. Anybody can call anything, anything. Okay, think of folksonomies as anchor text. You know, you can call Bush anything and put a little link to them. Right now, YouTube is allowing you to call him when you have that picture. Okay, so just as you can't control anchor text, you can't control tags. So the question is, how do you try to control the tag correctness? One is hope that with the more obvious, more meaningful tags, more correct descriptions will hopefully percolate up, because more people would have called Bush the president, hopefully. And so, you know, when you're looking for Bush picture, then the president Bush picture will show up. Okay. But then there may be many things on the web which probably only one guy, you know, annotated. And so now you're dependent on that one guy's goodness of heart to have annotated it correctly. So if you, it's like you could actually do worse by having really bad annotation, right, in terms of the quality of search. So what can you do? So you can design mechanisms that ensure correctness of tags. Currently there is, you know, if you think of the way YouTube allows tags, there is no mechanism. All you say, whatever you feel like, write it. So now you can, you know, design mechanisms. Now design of mechanisms is actually an interesting way of looking at what needs to be done. The word mechanism is used in the sense of economics and auction theory. So for example, in economics, they set up systems wherein people, I mean, if you left to themselves, you know, nobody's going to pay taxes. You know, who would want to pay taxes? And who would want to take care of common areas? Who would want to build roads? Okay, so the whole entire idea of economics is, one idea of economics is to set up mechanisms through which certain useful outcomes will occur. And the same thing with auctions. You set up a mechanism for an auction such that when you follow those mechanisms, certain useful properties can be guaranteed. For example, that the fairest price, you know, for this entity is, you know, you can get that from just the market. Okay, so right now we want mechanisms which will ensure the correctness of tags. Okay, here are two ideas. One is a simple one, one is much more complex. So the simple one is, for example, don't allow any random person to tag. First take their credit card, take their fingerprints, and tell them that if you tag badly, police will come and get you. Okay, and of course you'll get three people to tag, you know, they like, or pay them or some such thing. Okay, so this is, you know, it's a reasonable idea. I mean, it's not necessarily going to happen, and if, you know, for every piece of information on the web, but you know, there may be people who are willing to do this for money, and they'll give their money or whatever, but they don't mind being vetted before actually giving the tags. Okay, so for example, Google Corp, we mentioned some time back, essentially allows only certain people to tag the data, tag the pages. Okay, Google Corp, by the way, is the idea which allows you, when you look for diabetes in Google, you know, the normal pages will come, but above, on the top, it will give the trusted diabetes pages, for example. Now, how did you decide some pages are trusted more than others? It's more and over and above the backlink structure of the web. It's because somebody sat down and said, this is a trusted page. CDC pages on diabetes are trusted pages. Okay? And the way this is done is you allow people to add tags. Just as YouTube allows people to add tags to music, Google Corp allows people to add tags to pages. And those tags are then given weight, higher weight, during query, you know, page retrieval. Okay, but then they only allow certain people to give these tags. So you have to be at least registered. They still don't come and put you in jail, but you have to be registered, and they have a way of figuring out who gave what tag. Okay, that's one way. Yes.
What if we suppose that the majority of the tags are assigned correctly? Then we could use a subset of the tag pages to construct a learner and to build a learner, and then analyze the newly tagged pages, and if there would be a
So the thing is that I basically, you know, I'm making these as three extremes, three different pieces, but they can all go together. Okay, I mean, you can take some of this, and some of this. And automated information extraction is normally learning again. So it's a good idea. All I'm saying is, I'm just looking at the pure, only people do it. Only the page creators do it. Or only learning techniques afterwards do it. And then you can pick, you know, you can then mix and match afterwards. Okay? Okay. So, and then the much harder kind of idea is to make it, you know, don't actually restrict people from, from giving tags, but make a mechanism such that they will not be able to give wrong tags. That's much harder, but that's why auction design is hard. There are only so many kinds of auctions. Okay, the Vickery auction, the Dutch auction, and various others. There are only so many kinds of auctions. Because those have good properties. Somebody sat down and designed them. Okay? You don't just randomly say, here is a new auction mechanism, you use it, and then of course that may well mean that people can cheat it, for example. Okay? So how would you, so do people know ESP game? How many of you don't know ESP game? Okay, so I should mention to you, so only two people don't know ESP game. Okay. So ESP game is this idea which this guy came up with, what's his name? Louis Wanan, who essentially got this year's or last year's MacArthur Genius Grant. The guy just barely completed his PhD and he gets the MacArthur Genius Grant. So it's really, there's no justice in the world. He's a very smart guy. He actually, you can look for, there's a talk that he gave on this idea of ESP game and collaborative computation. That's really worth listening to. He's a very good speaker. But his basic idea is, if you're asking people to give tags to pictures, let's say, A, people don't like to do it for you. Why should they do it free for you? And B, there's no way you can guarantee that the tags that they do give are actually anything related to what's in the picture. So he came up with a great mechanism which sort of hits two birds with one stone, which is, he made a game. People like to play games, okay, games with points, so people like to play games and get points. And then in that game, all you do is you log into this game right now, and then you would be paired up with some other random person who also is logged into the game at the same time, and both of you are shown a picture, and you start pre-associating, you start writing words that come to your mind. That same thing the other person is doing too. And anytime there is an intersection between the set of words you are typing and the set of words they are typing, you get a point. So you feel good because you feel through ESP we are able to communicate. We're not talking, and yet just having this thing in the middle, we are saying the right thing. Okay? So they feel good. But what's more interesting is the tags are now guaranteed to be more accurate than one guy giving tags, because they're two random people and they said a specific word which is common. You know, they're pre-associating and they said a specific word in common. It's very hard. The probability that they both came up with the same wrong characterization of the picture is very low. Okay, there's only one truth, but many, one true characterization or few true characterizations of a picture and many wrong characterizations of a picture. So the probability that two people will come with the same wrong characterization of a picture is, you know, very low. The beauty of this is in the design of mechanism. Okay, the guy, this guy Louis Wanan designed the mechanism such that it's fun and it ensures tag correctness. And the best way to think about it is, again, you know, how do you design mechanisms like auctions such that people can't cheat? Somebody very carefully designed them. Okay? It's an art form as of now. There is not much, you know, I can say about what's the right way to do it. You know, in fact, this particular talk, he talks about a bunch of other extensions to this simple idea about, you know, using people to do this kind of tagging. Okay. The other thing, again, you know, so this related to this is the other issue, which is it's hard to get people to tag things in which they have no personal interest. Okay. The kind of ideas that people are focusing on for collaborative tagging is, as I said, make it fun. So ESP is able to make it into a game which is of interest to you, and so you might want to play. Okay. Or give some sort of delayed gratification. If not instant gratification, some delayed gratification. Okay. So many things like Google Co-op and Cyberse try to make the argument that if you do this and if your friends also do this, then somehow your search quality is going to improve. Okay. This kind of an argument is easier to make for smaller subgroups than for the entire world. Because if you're talking about the entire world, I tag whole bunch of people benefit from it. What's in it for me? You know, when is it going to start helping me? Okay. Whereas it's a small group of people. Suppose it's like the bunch of people who are interested in some particular type of XML query processing. Okay. They might develop like a collaborative bibliography of the paper. And they start tagging, okay, this paper has these things, this paper has these things. And hopefully, they can start seeing the reward much faster. Okay. Again, those are the sort of issues that are of interest when you're talking about collaborative tagging. Okay? Question? So the interesting part here is how to answer these questions, and I don't have a computer science-y answers, unfortunately, which will say here is the algorithm where, you know, whereby you can be guaranteed. If you give me a protocol, I can verify that it does have certain properties. So if you take a protocol like the ESP game, you can actually write a couple of theorems as to how little is the probability that two random people would say the same thing. Same wrong thing about a picture. But coming up with it is not as well defined. Okay. But it's going to be important. There are other kinds of, so this basic collaborative tagging is connected to the general problem that I mentioned in the beginning of the course, that, you know, one of the advantages of the web is you have many, many millions of eyeballs looking at the same thing. Not exactly the same thing, but the web. Okay? And how can you get them to do something for you? Free. Okay, by the way, did you guys get the subheading of my... Yeah. Did you guys get the subheading? Mice running the earth. No?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Of course.
What? So, Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy. You have to read Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy. The movie is really bad. Don't watch it. But, you know, either read the book or listen to the BBC radio series. Okay.
Play the game.
Okay. So according to Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy, essentially, it's the mice who created the Earth as a gigantic experiment where they're trying to figure out the question for which the answer is 42. You know, actually, they're trying to figure out the meaning of life. And then, you know, when the computer fails, the answer is 42. But anyway, so that's interesting because the reason I put that there is all these people are thinking they're having fun when they're playing ESP games. Nobody feels good about helping others. I mean, really, you know, I mean, it's very hard. You know, we are not wired that way, okay? So we have to be somehow told that we are having fun, and helping others has to come somehow indirectly without our knowledge, okay? So basically, when people are having fun, you wind up getting useful information, and that's the connection with the mice and the humans. Humans think that they are in charge of Earth, but apparently mice were running the Earth, according to Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy. Okay. Uh, So the last part, the third part, as I said in that case about collaborative tagging, so there was tagging at the creation time, collaborative tagging, automated information extraction. So that somehow after the fact, try to get the structure out, get the meaning out automatically. And once you get it out, you will remember it in some logical format. If you feel like, you can remember it in the RDF format. Okay, that's a reasonable idea. That's how all these things are connected. Okay, so the real question is, now, so that's what we'll be talking about, information extraction. Unfortunately, I'll tell you examples of information extraction. It's a huge sliding, slippery slope, we'll see in a minute, because if you do little too much information extraction, you're doing natural language processing. If you do too little, you're doing information retrieval. Okay, so information extraction is not well defined, other than by saying it's neither extremes. Okay, but it's like doing the piece of the natural language processing that's somehow easy. And it's like a badly defined area, but it's very useful. Okay, so we'll look at examples of techniques here, as well as, you know, the lay of the land, and then we'll see how it goes. So information extraction is defined as identifying specific pieces of information in an unstructured or semi-structured textual document. That's what it is, okay? And many things are actually templated pages, as I told you, and it's written in such a way that humans think it's in English or some natural language, but they really probably were generated from structured data to begin with. So in those cases, information extraction involves just undoing the damage. It was structured, it was made into quasi-English, information extraction reverts it. Okay, that aspect of information extraction is called wrapper generation. Okay, if on the other hand the original data was not structured to begin with, so that means there is, it's not a templated stylistic text, it's just normal freeform text, okay, that anybody, a natural speaker, would write, then information extraction is more like natural language processing. But you may not be able to do the full natural language processing, but you're doing pieces of it at least. Okay? So the kinds of applications, you know, information extraction in the maximum case, its applications would be anything that can, you know, that's an application of natural language processing, which is pretty much anything. You know, you can understand the complete meaning of a page the way the humans understand it. Obviously, you can support much better retrieval, much better querying, everything. Okay, but then you may be able to just get part of the meaning and remember that as the background, the knowledge in that page, and that still is not bad. Okay, it's not really that different from what we do. If you are reading a new paper, you don't get all of it the first time. You know, you get some semi-structure in the beginning. You get the title, that's it. You know, and then after a while, you just about understood the abstract. Maybe, you know, a little later you understand. So it's like you're getting more and more of the structure of the paper, you know, from English into your mental notation, whatever that is. Okay, information extraction is trying to do that too, rather than looking for the entire understanding of the entire meaning of the page. Okay, so the kinds of things that you can do are, you can, let's say, consider news group messages and try to guess and try to, you know, remove pieces from it, saying who wrote it, what is the topic of the message, what is the news group, etc., etc. Okay, like another example is Sightseer kind of databases, which look at computer science or any technical papers and then say, oh, this must be the author block, this must be the abstract block, and this must be the references block. And having figured that out, then they try to, you know, extract the piece from the author block, which is the author name, and similarly extract the various papers from the references block, and they will all be actual references pages. Okay, if you know Sightseer or Google Scholar or Libra, which is another system, all of them are basically doing this kind of extraction of information from the papers. They don't understand the paper, but they understand enough that they know where are the references, and they can actually then cross-link the references, so they can compute such useful metrics as who is the most cited author in computer science, which is the most cited paper in a certain area, which you cannot answer just by doing IR style analysis. And you can also not answer it using PageRank because there are no links. The links are in text. So there are indirect links and you have to extract the links essentially. So that's the kind of information extraction. Okay. Yeah. Another kind of things are classified advertisements. You know, most papers have these very highly stylized classified advertisements for jobs and so on. So the question is, if you can have a big database of all the advertisements that have ever been published, then you can allow people to do very nice querying on them. You know, you can ask things like, show me these kinds of jobs which are these many miles away from my home, which give at least more than this much salary and give at least more than these many days of vacation and give, you know, various types of dental insurance and all that stuff. Okay, so you can essentially, even though each of these pieces are being published as individual advertisements, you can act as if you have a single database where all of these have been stored in a structured form and do full database style retrieval. Okay, so those are all the kinds of examples that you can do. You can do information extraction. Let me first give you an example. Let's see. So suppose you have a posting like this. Let's say of a job posting. It's in English, right? And then the extractor might be able to look for things like, okay, here is the date, here seems to be the name of the job, and you know, here are all the things in red are things that it has actually extracted. And having extracted it, it can remember it into its own template for a job. Okay, so a job, it's a computer science job, it has an ID, it has a title, its country is known, the kinds of platforms that, you know, that you should be able to do work on is known, and the number of years of experience is known, and the post date is known, etc. Okay, now I'm not saying this is the entire meaning of this page, but in addition to this page, if I also give you this, this is an annotation. Think of this as an annotation of the old page. Now, sometimes I might just actually look at only the annotations. In the YouTube case, for example, it's not that the videos are gone. It's the videos plus tags. But the search currently still does only very simple tag-based search. If you go to this blinks.com, any of you have seen blinks.com? Which is this video search, direct video search. No, it does its own job there, but there it is actually trying to do search on the video itself directly, plus also use tags. Okay, YouTube doesn't look at the video itself, it just looks at the tags. Okay, so think of these extracted information becomes an annotation on the original file. That's the best way to think about it. It's not that the old file is lost, it's just this is the piece that you understand of the file. Okay, here is an Amazon book description in HTML, and you might be able to pick up these pieces using information extraction, and you might then say, well, title is this. So you know that these are all book data. So one of the things, for example, is if I show this to people who are coming from outside, you know, from just outside the road there, and say, hey, what is this? You don't have to tell them, by the way, what you're looking at is a job description. Now do you understand? They just start reading and they understand. Okay? And if you show them this page in HTML formatting, in full rendering, they will say, oh, this is not a job description, this is a book description. So they know that those are job descriptions, these are book descriptions. Information extraction systems generally tend to be much more domain specific. So there may be an extraction system which is more for just job description, and it only tries to do well for the job description. So, and this, there may be one for Amazon book descriptions, and that does a good job on the books. And if you throw the book one on the job one, all bets are off. Okay, this is not too unlike the old expert systems. Any of you remember expert systems in? Okay, so there was actually, if you go to the CS Night this time, this guy called Ted Shotliff is going to be giving a talk there, who did one of the very first expert systems for medicine called Mycin. And so Mycin does one thing and it does that well, that's it, nothing else. Okay, all it does is it was able to predict, given description of a patient, it was able to predict what kind of internal medicine disease that this particular person might be suffering from. That's all it's good at. Okay, and you know, people have, for example, given to Mycin the description of their car, automobile, and the system happily said this car does not have this internal medicine disease, but it does have possibly this other disease, because it has no clue. It's only good at doing what it does. Okay, so you can think of information extraction versus NLP as the difference between Mycin versus general intelligence, or a difference between a chess playing program like Deep Blue versus general intelligence. They're good at one piece but not the whole thing. Okay, but you know, it has use. You don't if you're not interested in just automating the entire human intelligence and perception, you know, this does have some use. Okay, so in this case, you know, you would be able to say that since I'm only going to be looking for books, all I ever will learn, I have this little book, I mean this little template in which I can write down what I learned about the book. Okay, so the slots would be title, author, list price, blah blah blah. Now these things make no sense for a computer science job. But if you take the system which does this and apply it to this, it will then come up with something like this, where it will throw in the numbers it found as the book price and so on. Not surprising. Okay. So, I think part of what I was trying to do is explain that information extraction really is NLP light. Okay, natural language processing, but not done the full. Okay, but as IE becomes more ambitious and text becomes more free form, then ultimately information extraction is natural language processing. Okay, but there is one thing that is interesting about information extraction, which originally at least natural language processing didn't have, which is an extra facilitator now because of the web, which is you have massive amounts of text, massive corpora, okay, massive amounts of text. Okay, that allows certain types of techniques, such as statistical natural language processing, which really could not be done as well in the old days, because even though everything was written, it was not easily accessible in a machine readable form. Okay, it was all meant, it was all on paper and people can read it, but it wasn't readable for a machine. Now, with you know, web pages, with digitized collections everywhere, you actually have the corpus that's available. Okay, and it winds up being quite useful, because certain kinds of things that you could not do before, you could do now. Remember long back in the beginning of the semester, I said you can ask Google whether water flows uphill or downhill. Okay, you could only ask that. It makes no sense to, you know, to figure out whether water flows uphill or downhill in any realistic sense is much harder. But just throwing that entire query to the Google and seeing how many hits are there for water flowing uphill and how many hits are there for water flowing downhill does give you a reasonable answer to the question, only because there's so many pages. If there are too few pages, the answer for both would be zero, and it doesn't tell you anything. Okay, so the corpora does make a difference, and so you know, it's the fact that natural language processing has increasingly become statistical was actually helped by the web. Okay, so that's one interesting connection between, you know, in terms of information extraction and natural language processing. Okay. So you know, there's a history for information extraction even before web came along. For example, there is this whole conference by DARPA called Message Understanding Conference, which essentially would want programs that can read large amounts of text data. Those days, probably there is email even those days, but especially newspaper articles and so on, and see if they are about terrorists, if there are specific terrorist events mentioned there, or whether there are joint ventures between industries mentioned there, company management changes are mentioned in an article. Okay, it's not unlike job, looking at a job description free text and converting it into what type of a job is it, what is the salary, etc. And the moment you do have that structure, okay, you can do much better processing. You can do aggregation queries, you can do selection queries, you can do complex selection queries. You can say, give me jobs which have this property and don't have this property. All those things you can do. Okay. So what's the difference between doing information extraction on this and coming up with this versus full semantic web approach, presumably? Versus actually knowing the entire meaning of this page. What would that have been represented as? My answer would be that ultimately, if you understand the complete knowledge in this particular article, that would be a bunch of logical sentences. If you believe in deterministic logic representations, it'll be a bunch of logical sentences, which in the context of background theory make complete sense, and so you can do more interesting inferences. I would say that this is just a subset. This looks like a slot filler structure, but this too actually corresponds to a bunch of logical sentences. It's just that it's not the full set of logical sentences defining this particular article. Okay, so when I say area voice mail, then I basically think of it as area of message equal to, platform PC DOS OS to a Unix. Then essentially what you're saying is platform of the job is PC or DOS or OS to or Unix. That's the sentence. It's just that you wrote only some of the sentences, and logical theories can be incomplete. You can just write what you know about the situation, and you can write whatever background knowledge you have with respect to that, you can support inference. Okay, so that's where this is connected. Okay. So this is the basic idea of information extraction. As I said, it's a slippery slope between not doing anything at all versus doing full natural language processing. And the two pieces of information extraction that are actually easy to kind of differentiate is extraction from pages that were originally generated by specific templates. So they started from structured data, and there was a template which converted them into an HTML page, and then you're just undoing it. Okay, the reason that is versus just free-form text. Okay, in this first case, essentially, you can assume that there is almost simple syntactic structures that you can do to figure out what are the slot fillers. In fact, one idea that comes up in information extraction is slot fillers. Okay, so you are looking at this thing with the interest of filling the slot in this template, because you assume that all you are looking at this for is, to see what are the various values of each of these slots. And similarly, you are looking at this thing to fill the slots of these. So you can think of extraction, as a sort of a slot filling activity. Then I also mentioned that slot filling can itself be thought of as understanding meaning, because slot filling is logical sentences. You write more logical sentences, that's full meaning. Okay. This is basically repeating something that I probably already mentioned several times, which is, this idea of going from originally structured to HTML back to structured. It's this inversion is called wrapper generation, and it also has all sorts of interesting names like screen scraping, which is kind of somebody put real data as an HTML page and you're scraping pieces off the screen and putting it into different slots. Okay, the assumption is that you assume that this thing was generated from something like this, and you are just undoing the conversion. Okay, now if that is the case, you can assume that there is some some high regularity in the way various pieces occur in the HTML page. So normally you can, so for example, remember my favorite example is the capital of India is New Delhi. And so if I write a whole bunch of sentences like that, right, you can always pick up the country and capital by beginning of the line, skip, 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 pick, skip, pick. That's it. Right? So you can write keyboard macros if you are a Emacs person, or you can write a bunch of regular expressions which basically pick these pieces. Okay. In the context of HTML, actually, it also helps to see the HTML tree corresponding to the page, and you can actually see that interesting pieces appear in about the same syntactical place in the HTML tree. So for example, for the Amazon book example, right? So you start with the HTML, here's the header, here's the body, and HTML is XML, right? And so XML has XML can be thought of as a rooted tree, so does HTML can also be thought of as a rooted tree. Okay? Where the interior nodes are the element names. Okay? So here is, if you look at this book, it actually looks like this: HTML body B, the age of spiritual machines, then font by, and then A, Ray Kurzweil. Okay? Now, so you can actually see that to get to the title, start from the top, okay, start from HTML, go to body, and go to a B, and then get the character data. Okay, there would be multiple books, each page, if it's a single book in each page, then this is how you get the title of the book. Now, if it's humans writing this, they are not guaranteed to follow a single template. If it was originally a structured piece of data and somebody wrote a little program, the program is not going to be complex enough to change the structure all the time, change the template all the time. So it's more likely than not that it's going to be putting the page in exactly the same structure again and again, with very few exceptions. And so what it also means is you can actually just pick pieces off from the HTML tree. Okay? So here is my way of, so I would say the title field, so for the title field here, right, instead of, all I can say is to get the title field, here is the expression that you need to do. Okay, go from HTML to body to B and then pick the character data. Okay, and for the author field, HTML body font A character data. Okay, now the question of course is, this is not hard for one book. Okay, and there is enough software support for doing this kind of keyboard macros, essentially something like keyboard macro or something like regular expression following on this HTML tree, path expression following on the HTML tree. Okay, the real question of course is, doing it for one, easy. Doing it for a million pages which keep changing little, mind-numbingly boring. But that's where you have bachelor students for. They lead jobs, so you say you get $45,000 per year, do this. And they'll do it, if you give a lot of money. I'm not making this up. In fact, in the first level of web, the so-called great web jobs were all essentially people writing these things by hand, screen scraping by hand, okay? But at the end of the month, they get good money, and so there's these two ways of living, right? You live to work or work to live. Working to live, okay? So the life starts after the work is over. And you know, unfortunately, these are internet companies, work is already 18 hours of your day, and so there's very little life. But the important point is that you can make people do really bad things if you give them money. And you know, screen scraping is what many internet company people were doing. And these were the jobs. Okay, they won't say screen scraping is what you would do, but that's what you would do. But now less and less of that is being done. Okay. Now what's painful, of course, is you would write this and you would stay, and then somebody on the Amazon side thinks, you know, I really need this thing not in bold but italic with a little blink on the side. Okay. So they change it. And then you don't know this, so overnight all the things that you extracted are all gobbledygook. Right? And so this, wow, something went wrong. And then you essentially rewrite this. This is wrapper maintenance. So writing these expressions, these are wrappers. Okay? And then you have to write them, which is painful, and you have to maintain them. When the other guy keeps making changes, you have to make sure that you make the opposite changes. Okay? It's not hard, it's not AI complete, it's not really hard problem, but it's mind-numbingly dull problem. You know, and it can be done by paying somebody. Okay. So one of the interesting things, of course, is even here you can start doing interesting types of automation. So, for example, the slots in a, you know, you basically have templates, and you can think of extraction as filling up the slots in the various templates. Okay. So the slots might have some fixed or pre-specified possible fillers. So sometimes basically the slots, this is the title, for example. Okay, suppose you're looking for the genre of the book. So is it a Western? Is it a romance? Is it a pulp fiction? Okay, sometimes the book description may not give that. Okay, in the case of jobs, is this a mind-numbingly dull job, or is it a fun kind of a job? You know, who writes anything other than fun job in the job description, right? If they say mind-numbingly dull, they have to add extra $1 million to your salary. So you have to pick. So essentially, sometimes, even though I meant it sound as if extraction is all about just picking, you know, things off the page and writing, you know, filling it into the existing slots, some of the slots might be talking about meta properties of the entire page that don't actually exist in exactly that way. Okay, so for example, job type, they may or may not say clerical, service, custodian. It's just a description of the job, but knowing the job type will help you, because you know, people may be actually looking for clerical jobs, and there are many, many types of clerical jobs, but they're looking for overall clerical jobs, and they'll then, you know, look. Additional piece of hierarchical knowledge. Okay, so when you have something like this, how would you do the extraction? What you would have to do essentially is, you can, here is a case, first case, where you can do classification learning techniques that you already know. Okay, suppose I give you 15 pages. Suppose there are, you know, job type can only be clerical, service, or custodial, only three types. So I take about 100 pages, manually classify them. This is a clerical job, this is a custodial job, this is some other job. And I gave you 100 pages, text documents, and their classes. Learn a classifier. The classifier is going to look at the entire page, okay, and say it's custodial, it's clerical, it's something else. You can do NBC, you can do any whatever. You know, there may not be any single word that gives away what the class of this page is, but all the words together push it towards one class versus other class. And you can train your learner on it. So here is a scenario where you do much of the extraction manually, because you write the manual, you know, you write the wrapper itself manually. But then you can, these kinds of things you can't do it manually, because you have to look at every page to see what it is. So for those, you just write a classification learner. Okay, so I would assume that you would know how to do it, because you already know text classification. Okay, now for regarding the wrapper itself, okay, which is for the parts that actually correspond to specific screen scraping. Okay, there are various types of techniques all of which of specifying a wrapper. Ultimately, you could think of them as providing some sort of a path expression on the HTML tree. So you need to provide the path expression that will be run on your HTML page, and whatever that path expression returns, that would be the answer. That would be the piece that goes into that particular slot. Okay. There are certain extra complexities on this, because it may be that sometimes you can't just right away jump into the title, for example. I mean, right away jump into the space, the value of a slot. There may be text that starts telling you in the template, in the HTML template, that the slot's value is about to come. Okay, so you first look for that, then you pick the next part, and then you also know when the slot value ends. Okay, so you can essentially have pre-filler pattern, post-filler pattern, and filler pattern. And each of these could be path expressions or regular expressions. And normally that's like the more general way of providing. Look for this, then when you find this, then you pick the next couple of things, remember, you know, keep it, and when you have reached this part, then you know you have stopped. Then you have no, you extract it. Okay? So this already said, if you have a slot has a fixed set of pre-specified filters, then you can do text classification idea. Okay. So this is the way you do wrapper generation. You can actually do learning for the wrapper generation itself. I'll mention that briefly next class, and also mention briefly next class about what sort of extraction can you do on unstructured text, which is not originally generated from a structured piece of structured database record. And it turns out the interesting thing there is, just as HTML can be thought of as the syntax, the rendering syntax of the page, English has its own syntax that you guys learned. You know, I mean, those of you who learned English in grade school know that you can take a sentence and split it into noun phrase, verb phrase, and there's this whole idea of part of speech tagging. And if you do grammar analysis of a sentence, that looks very much like an HTML tree. Sentence begin, noun phrase has, you know, noun, and the verb phrase has verb, and bunch of things. And so you can first do grammar analysis, just the syntax analysis of the sentence, and write the pattern extractors in terms of these grammar trees. Okay? That's what you would wind up doing for unstructured text. We'll talk more about that next slide.